for folks exactly what... it's like I can hear myself in Steve's machine.
I'm trying to get after in terms
of appointing this committee. I was at a gathering of Senate presidents a couple weeks back and heard a discussion from National Conference of State Legislatures on the stimulus package, and almost around the room with the Senate presidents was a universal lack of understanding of the stimulus package and what was required. NCSL was proposing that Senate presidents advocate very strongly for states' positions in the stimulus package, but again, I don't think people knew exactly what they were supposed to be advocating for. So I came back to Missouri and said we need to have a process by which we start to understand this package. So the challenge I would like to give you as a committee is to first gather information and try to understand exactly what is in the stimulus package and what the opportunities are. The second would be to advocate where proper for Missouri's position. I think it is very clear that states will have different positions on different parts of the stimulus package, and within our congressional delegation, also with NCSL, when it is proper for you to advocate for Missouri's position to do so. The third would be to make sure that Missouri is in a position to take maximum advantage of the opportunities that might be provided in the stimulus package, whether that is budgetary opportunities, whether we have to pass legislation sooner than later to take advantage of the stimulus opportunities to do so. And then the fourth would be a cautionary role, and that is to make sure you understand the package to the point where while there will be opportunities within the stimulus package, make sure we don't put ourselves in a position that creates a short-term gain that we will not be able to sustain for years to come. In other words, don't sign up to buy the new car with all the options when you're not sure you'll be able to make the payments after the rebate check comes in. So those are the challenges that I would present to the committee, and I look forward to hearing back your work. We've got you on a fairly short time frame. We organize this around areas of expertise and as it coordinates with the stimulus package and the federal departments, and I look forward to hearing your work.
Great. Thank you very much, Senator. First, we're going to just the agenda. We're going to start off. We got some very good assistance from NCSL. We have two people on the line. They're going to discuss with us the federal stimulus package. We got Carl and Michael. Carl is the Deputy Executive Director. He's going to give us an overview of what NCSL has done and what is immediately available to help our task force, mission. And then Michael's going to go into the process, the timing, and to basically just touch on general topics and related matters of what the economic recovery legislation entails. So, fellas, are you on the line?
We're here. We're happy to be here. And during our conversation, if you have trouble hearing us, let us know, and we'll speak closer to the microphones that we're using. So this is Carl Tubesing. I'm the Deputy Executive Director of NCSL and also a native of Missouri, so and proud of it. I'd like to start first by congratulating you for creating this special committee. As we've talked around the office about economic recovery, it's clear to us that the faster that legislatures can be ready to deal with the legislation once it's passed, the better off they are. And as I think Senator Shields was noting, that there will be a lot of attention paid to how states are dealing with the funds and the programs that are coming their way, and creating this committee before the legislation is passed, I think, is extremely important and shows a lot of foresight. NCSL actually began working on an economic stimulus package a year ago, and if you recall, the Speaker Pelosi and President Bush a year or so ago agreed to a fairly scaled-down package, which was basically what they were able to agree on at the time. But we, not knowing that it would be a fairly scaled-down package, that we at that time created a set of 8 recommendations that we thought would be most helpful to states in pulling out of the economic problems that they were facing. And Michael will talk more about what those 8 recommendations are, but throughout the last 12 months, we have been consistent in advocating those 8 recommendations, did them throughout the year. And last fall, when it appeared that the Congress and the President might once again be able to agree on a stimulus package, we ramped up our efforts and continue to push those 8 recommendations. We're very happy now that with having seen both the House bill and just within the last half hour seeing the Senate legislation, that 7 of our 8 recommendations are included in the bills in one way or the other. As I indicated, Michael will give you an overview of what those recommendations are, where things stand in the process, but I would like to point out 2 very useful mechanisms that we've created over the last few weeks for you and your colleagues around the country to stay on top of these developments. One is a special web page that we've created on ncsl.org that is full of side-by-sides and summaries and links to legislation, links to other analyses, numbers, questions and answers, a whole range of things. And we don't know exactly what the record for hits are on an NCSL webpage, but the last 4 days we've had over 1,000 hits on that page, and we're claiming the record. We don't know whether it's true or not, but we're claiming it. And the other mechanism is a weekly call that takes place on Thursday afternoons at 2:00 your time. And there, if any of you want to participate, go to the website where there's a place to email for the call-in information. We're not making this available beyond legislators and staff, so we need to get the email from you before we can send the conference call information out. With that, I'll turn it over to Michael, unless there are any questions before we go to the overview and the details.
Go ahead, Michael.
Hello, this is Michael Bird, Federal Affairs Counsel for NCSL. Thank you for this opportunity to be with you this afternoon. You are undertaking a very huge task here, and hopefully we'll be able to assist you as you move through your process and to whatever action you decide to take, you know, as a legislature in Missouri. I'm from Illinois, so I'm from at least close by. I think, just to make it simple, there are 2 pieces of legislation moving, and these will be the numbers that, in terms of when you reference anything, or if you look on the Internet, you talk to your congressional delegations, and that's H.R. 1 and S. 1. And in this town, you know, we only talk in terms of billions and trillions these days. So the House bill, when you take a look at its line, you're talking about $825 billion. The Senate bill, when it emerged from its 2 committees yesterday, was getting very close to $900 billion, just a little bit shy of that. And the main difference between the 2 bills, at least in terms of that number, is that the Senate has a 1-year patch to the application of the alternative minimum tax. Now, in terms of the areas that NCSL has concentrated on, and I should at least stop here briefly to say that we have additional NCSL staff available so that when we get into the questions regarding maybe specific programs or general topic areas, they will be able to respond in addition to whatever Carl and I are able to provide. For states, there is a boost in the federal match for Medicaid. This would have been much easier to explain a few minutes ago, but the Senate has come up with a brand new formula that it doesn't look anything like the House formula, so we'll leave it. Hopefully I can leave it there. But approximately, we're still talking about approximately an $87 billion over 27 months in a federal match boost for Medicaid with another pot, at least over on the House side, for those states that have had high unemployment increases. There is a second area which is found throughout various pieces of both the Senate and House bills that addresses that nebulous term infrastructure. And this runs everywhere from your traditional roads, bridges, mass transit, and water treatment, safe drinking water, to now a variety of energy efficiency grants, to school construction, funds for universities and beyond, for broadband expansion and for health information technology. That's pretty much the bookends for the infrastructure world. A third component deals with tax cuts, and this is a combination of tax credits, and primarily which NCSL has advocated for, that the credits tend to not have any effect on state revenue bases. And of course, since states are experiencing revenue problems, if they were to go into worlds beyond the credits, then these do raise questions for legislators as to whether or not they want to couple or decouple from changes the federal government makes. But the tax cuts are for individuals. There's going to be some business tax changes in terms of bonus depreciation, net operating loss lookbacks, small business expensing. These were made available last year. Now they're just extended for another year. Probably next to tax cuts, the largest pot of funding that's in both bills is in the education area. And it runs from filling in some of the unfunded mandates for special education over a two-year period to the unfunded mandates that apply in Title I and No Child Left Behind over a two-year period. There's additional funding both to enhance what you're already doing and incentives to go beyond what you're doing in terms of early childhood education, preschool, education technology, and school construction. And like I said, that package, at least over on the House side, probably is around $150 billion when you take everything out. And there's something in there that's called the Stabilization Fund we should probably talk about when we get to the question part. There's a variety of assistance for individuals who have been most disadvantaged by the recession. And this would be an extension of unemployment insurance benefits, supplemental food stamp benefits, a variety of funding for an array of human services programs. Finally, there's a complete energy component and environment component. Now, some of this is, if in the media would be where they talk about green jobs, but this is energy efficiency, a variety of credits for renewable and alternative fuels. Some of this is an extension of stuff that's already on the books. Some of it is brand new. Now, overriding all of this, and I think some of the issues that are really important for you, most but not necessarily all of these programs are going to follow existing formula for distribution to the states or to local governments or to both. And I say for the most part, that's where there's been an awful lot of tension, particularly in this town, where I would say representatives of the executive branch at the state and at the local level have been trying to get this money sent directly to them, and are succeeding in part. There will be conditions and requirements attached to some of these funds. And if you go to our website, you'll be able to see some of those. We are still sorting through all of these, which may or may not be an incentive for you to even accept this money. There will be maintenance of effort requirements for certain of these funds. And finally, there are more than likely going to be provisions in here that are going to require you to take legislative action, both on the fiscal side and perhaps even on the substantive side. As Carl said, I mean, seven of the eight things that NCSL advocated for, which was the Medicaid boost, the UI, the food stamp, the infrastructure component, the discretionary grants that are in here, the use of tax credits, and have all found their way in one place or another into both of these bills. And we certainly thank you for any of the efforts that you have made to have these happen. I think it would be best if we stood. I stopped there and we just took questions.
All right, Michael. Thank you. We appreciate that. First off, what is your anticipated timeline on this being moved in?
As you are meeting the United States House of Representatives is on the floor. They are voting today on H.R. 1. The rule that they passed for floor debate allows for the for a vote on 11 amendments. The amendments range anywhere from one that deals only with mass transit to one which would gut all of the bill except for the tax provisions. This bill is, I think, if you were betting, is likely to pass sometime today, and then we'll move on to the Senate. The Senate, the two committees that have jurisdiction over on the Senate Finance Committee and the Senate Appropriations Committee, both marked up their draft legislation yesterday. That is now being stitched into one bill and being placed into S1, so that the language on all of this just became available. I mean, and this has really been a moving target because we've been working from drafts, we've been working from outlines. The leadership and the president have both said that they wanted to have something done by President's Day. Right now, I'd say that's that is certainly a possibility. That would be warp speed for the Congress, but they seem intent on moving expeditiously. You should know, and I think this is sort of inside baseball in Washington, D.C., that the House and the Senate tend to pre-conference their legislation that's moved through both houses. That is where they have identical or very close to identical provisions. The two chambers will essentially allow their staff to sign off on those provisions and then leave to the members the areas of both minor and sometimes greater disagreement. The big decision will then be whether to actually go to conference committee or not. If you go to conference committee, this becomes a Senate issue because there you have a 60-vote threshold. Any dissenting members can filibuster and can call for votes that require 60 votes on almost anything. And this is when the Congress sometimes gets into what they call the game of ping pong. And that is they keep passing back new bills until they get one that's the one they want. I mean, that's a little inside baseball, but I think it means that over the course of the next 2 weeks, this is the time for you to really get close to your congressional delegation and to look into these issues. If there's something there that you either don't like, it's confusing, strips you of your authority, raises questions about conditions, please call us and go to our website. I mean, we are updating our website several times a day in some instances because that's how fluid this information is.
Great. Thank you, Michael. Any questions from the senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question's directly going. I don't know. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Jason Crowell, and my area of question goes directly to the nature of this funding. You said this is 27 months. Can you explain basically what you mean by that? Is as it relates to the federal fiscal years that run on October, our state fiscal years run on July, and when is this able to be drawn down versus the federal government? And I assume it's temporary funding, not permanent funding.
that's an exceptionally good assumption. We're talking about federal fiscal year, October 1, starting October 1, 2009, which would be fiscal year 10, federal fiscal year 10, and federal fiscal year 11 for 24 months. The exception to that at this point in time would be the Medicaid program, which will go for an additional quarter. So they would be 27 months.
So
otherwise, we're talking 24 months.
So when can a state begin to draw this money down from the federal government?
It's going to depend on I mean, education money is usually forward funded. I think we're going to have to transportation money probably right away, or Medicaid money first quarter, October 1.
So
the answer could be different depending upon each of these individual programs. Can we get back to you on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to me because we base our state budget on fiscal years that will start this July 1. And if you're telling me I can't draw down this federal dollars, what am I going to do for July, August, September, October for 4 months?
This is Molly Ramsdell from NCSL. On the transportation funds, while we don't have the details on the Senate proposal, on the House proposal, after enactment, the Secretary of Transportation at least has to make the allotments for each state available within 7 to 10 days after the enactment. And with the idea that the contracts for these kind of shovel-ready, ready-to-go jobs would be awarded within 180 days. But that just applies to my areas in the transportation infrastructure grants.
And I appreciate that. I'm probably more questioning the area of the enhanced Medicaid matches. We have had proposals by our governor to enhance eligibility on Medicaid, and my direct questions would be, when would we be able to draw those enhanced Medicaid match funds so that we could realize them in our state? And then if you could speak, this is not permanent money. This is one-time money.
Joy, are you on right now?
Yes, I am.
Joy Wilson is our Medicaid expert, and she's at home today because of an ice storm, but she can perhaps answer your question.
The Medicaid money runs from October 1 of 2008 through December 31st of 2010. So you get the enhanced match during that period. That's called the recession period.
So would we have to I don't know how you would go back in time. Do we redraw down what we already drew down starting
I assume they'll reconcile, giving
well,
you the
I
new
understand
match.
We have a whole bunch of assumptions, but I guess that would be, at some point, would be my question, is the framework so that we know this is actually real money.
Well,
that makes sense.
Yes, the Medicaid is forward funded anyway, so, and they always have to reconcile because the bills come in, so I think you're fine there. If that's the period, they will give you the enhanced match during the period as long as you meet the requirements.
And what are those requirements, and what exactly is the enhanced match?
Well, the enhanced match at this point is a moving target, because the House has one set of provisions and the Senate just created something new yesterday. So they will have to conference on actually what the enhanced match will be. In the House, they have a flat rate that applies across the board to everybody, and it's 4.9%. So you would add 4.9 to your current matching rate. With a little, there's a little catch there. If your matching rate was higher in FY08 than it is now, because you know it changes every year, you get the higher. You get the higher level, and then you add the 4.9% to that level.
And Mike, and then along those lines, is that forever? Or does that go?
No, it's only during the recession period. So that period I mentioned between basically fiscal year 09 through the first quarter of fiscal year 11.
Okay. So what are states supposed to do when the federal government takes that money away?
Well, presumably, the recession will be over,
okay,
and you won't need all that extra money.
That is a something of a problem with a lot of this funding, which is that
right,
it does go away, and states will be counting on it for that two-year period or more, and then it does go away.
I don't know if you've had other states that have discussed this, but just back-of-the-envelope calculations, our appropriation staff has said that when the federal funds go away, our state is going to have to experience 7.4% growth to basically make up for the federal money. Are any other states experiencing that, and would NCSL project 7.4% growth in the state of Missouri in 2011?
I can't, I don't know about that, but I do know that other states have observed that at the end of the recession period, you have to keep in mind that that bump is going to disappear.
I mean, my concern would be, and I don't know if this is the appropriate way to do it, but I don't want the federal government to be the state of Missouri's Freddie or Fannie Mae and sell me a house I can't afford, and then it be foreclosed in 3 years.
Right. Yeah, you make a
point. Well, here is what I would say. Medicaid is an entitlement program. So if you get a rush of new enrollees, you can't cut them off if they meet the minimum requirements. And in a recession, a lot of the lower income people who are eligible but have not enrolled will enroll in Medicaid. And then you would have to find the money to keep to provide service to them. So in some respects, this is to help a state take up that slack, because you have low-income people who have jobs who are either getting something from their job or choosing not to participate in Medicaid and paying out of pocket.
And
if they lose that job, they might come on.
And I understand that. So is the thought process from NCSL, and you guys know this far more than me, that this enhanced match should be used to deal with those new people on Medicaid, or should we create new eligibility requirements and new programs with this Medicaid funding?
Well, that, of course, is a policy question for every state to consider, but depending on, and it kind of depends on how bad your unemployment is and how many, and what you think your pickup is going to be. But it would seem to me that your first option would be to make sure that as new people come on, you have funds to provide the service to them.
With your current eligibility guidelines?
Yes.
And then if you can project, if you have any leftover funds, you could move up your eligibility guidelines for Medicaid accordingly.
Yes, and let me throw in the last requirement, because this is key.
Okay.
Both the House and the Senate have a provision called maintenance of effort.
We are familiar with maintenance.
On eligibility.
So if we enhance eligibility here, we can't roll it back when the federal funds go away.
Well, yes, you can when the federal funds go away, but you can't roll them back while you're receiving the enhanced match.
Okay.
So that being the case, you know, it's not who's on your rolls now, but how many people, given your eligibility, could possibly come on. And I think that's what you have to be looking at, because you can't do anything on eligibility
and get the
enhanced match.
And this would be for a 27-month period?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Senator, you're definitely on the right track here, and I'm sure that your staff has, and the appropriations and fiscal folks there have figured all this out. But, you know, Joy is talking primarily about entitlement and other mandatory programs. When you get to a program, let's say, like special education, which is coming out of general fund money, I think what you have to kind of look at down the road is that for the next 2 years, if you decide to participate, you will get additional federal money to pay for your special education program or for your Title I program. At the end of a two-year period, that money at this point in time would dry up. And then you're back to mean, they're filling in the gap. They're filling in right now on a temporary basis, but then you're going to have to make a decision. Well, do you continue? Will you be able, if the federal money does not continue at the level that you've gotten accustomed to over a two-year period, what are your choices? What are your decisions?
Would they? Is there a provision for Haldol or some kind of methadone that we will then be able to wean ourselves off of the federal juice?
We'll look into that.
All right. Thank you.
This is Senator Roop. Can you speak to the transportation piece? Any idea of, you know, the dollar amounts that the Senate and the House have primarily for new construction on road projects?
Sure. This is Molly Ramsell. For the most part, right now, and while we haven't seen the final, you know, the legislative, we're just getting through the legislative text of the Senate, the House bill has $30 billion with a few, you know, $300 million taken off for Indian roads and $250 million for parks, but basically $30 billion for highways, bridges, and the funds would go to states through the existing formula in safety lieu. The Senate has less funds, about $27 billion for highway investments. Now, you said for new construction projects, one of the things that you have to remember is in both the House and the Senate version, they're basically requiring 50% of these funds to be obligated, meaning under award, under contract, within 180 days. So there has been the thought that a large portion of these funds would be really used for maintenance and repair because it would be difficult to get new construction jobs off the, you know, off and running. But that doesn't mean it can't be used for that. It's just the fact that it may be difficult to get those projects underway. I do want to point out, while we haven't seen the legislative text yet, the summary that the Senate Appropriations Committee released yesterday does have some provisions in it that we are a little bit concerned, a lot concerned about. As it relates to the $27 billion, it discusses how the first half of the funding will go to the states, and it has to be obligated within 180 days. And I should mention that unobligated funds basically go back to the Department of Transportation, and they would be reallocated to other states. But as for the second half of funding, and again, this is just based on a summary we've seen, it says of that funding, 20% of that will be distributed to states and 80% will be distributed directly to local governments, with the idea that in the end, roughly 60% of the formula funded will go to states, with 40% being sub-allocated to local governments. Like I said, we haven't seen the legislative text. Is this a pass-through? Is it direct funding to local governments? We don't know that yet, but we hope to have an answer later today and get that information up on our webpage.
Great. Thank you. Senator Days?
Rita Days, I did not hear anything about public transportation, mass transit. Is there any allocation for that?
We're sorry. We can't hear the question.
I'm sorry. My mic's not working.
The question was she didn't hear anything about mass transit in that piece. Could you address that?
Sure. Both the House and the Senate bill, again, we haven't seen all the provisions, have funding for mass transit. The Senate bill right now looks to be a little bit more generous. The House bill has $6 billion for transit capital grants, and the Senate has $8.4 billion for transit grants. But again, it appears in at least the House bill, and I should have mentioned this on the highway funds as well, there's a maintenance of effort requirement there as well. But we don't know, let me see, anything else on the Senate. No, we just know for the most part it's $8.4 billion for investments in public transportation. The funding will be distributed by formula to local areas using formula set in current transit authorization law. And again, the first half of the funding has to be obligated within 180 days. And I should add that in most cases, the additional funding, the remaining funding, has to be obligated within 1 year of their distribution. On the transportation, there's also funding, which if you want me to go into the detail, I'd be more than happy to, on some rail and aviation and some funds, at least in the House bill, for Amtrak.
Senator Schaefer, I think, had a question.
This is Kurt Schaefer. I've got a question. Is this one not working either? We must have.
We can hear you.
Okay. I've got a question on the $150 billion for education, and I've seen some of the drafts, but I haven't seen an updated one since last week. Do we have a sense of what percentage of that $150 billion is for capital improvements and construction projects as opposed to other things?
We don't have our education person here, but we're going through the paper. Just give us a second. Sorry. Yeah.
And I'd have a follow-up question, too, while you're looking through that, and sure. That is that going to have, especially on the construction projects, a similar requirement that was just mentioned regarding transportation, where you've got a commitment to 50% of those funds within 180 days?
You know, I think maybe if we went on to another question, and then we could research this and then get back to you while we're still on the phone.
Sure. This is Senator Roop again. Is there any caveats to any of the funding that if we were to refuse this piece, do we just get qualified for any other pieces, or is this all separate pots that we will get the opportunity to pick and choose from?
It's the latter. That they're basically, as Michael said, they're basically set up through existing programs and existing formulas, and there's no penalty for not participating in one and not another.
Senator Pierce?
Yeah, I have a question. When you talked about the sub-allocating of funds and going directly to the local units, if that's the case, what role does the state play? Does the state still filter those, or are they on their own? What do you recommend the states do on that sub-allocation?
Great question, but unfortunately at this time I don't have an answer for you because we actually haven't seen the legislative text on the Senate transportation fund. So we don't know if it is a pass-through. Like I said, we're just working from a summary, and until we see the legislative text, we really don't know the mechanism by which that's flowing. But I think Michael here wants to add something.
Senator, was your question directed just to the transportation issues?
Well, that's when it was brought up, but if it applies to other areas as well, I think that's something that we need to be aware of, that you know, we want to give all the tools we can to our local communities, and yet we don't want them cannibalizing each other. And is this really where we think as a state that the money should be spent? And then also, how can we help them?
Senator, this is Tamara Spielberg. I do environment and energy. With regards to some of the individual programs that are being funded in the House bill, some of those programs have direct funding to localities as part of the way that program was set up. So I think the case is going to be different depending on which pot of money you're looking at because, for example, in the energy field, there's the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant that was authorized in the 2007 Energy Independence and Security Act. It had not been funded to date, and the new funding provided for in the House bill would have to go through various levels, some of which would come to the state, but with a pass-through requirement to go to the localities. Some goes directly straight through to localities without involving the state. It would depend on which portion of money within that program you're talking about. So I think that's very illustrative of the fact that, again, things are going to be different depending on which program you're talking about.
Senator, in addition to Tamara's comments, the stabilization fund that's found within the education component, this is the tug of war that I was referring to earlier, where if you read the House and Senate provisions as they were originally, these are funds that are provided directly to the governor for his or her application. Now, as you can well imagine, since we work for you, that we fully believe that the power of the purse still belongs to the legislature and that the legislature should be the one who's making those decisions. Now, and
while it is different depending upon from state to state, some states have constitutional requirements that all money, whether it's anticipated or not, that comes from the federal government must be appropriated by the legislature to a state where they actually don't have any authority whatsoever over federal funds unless they're in session. So I think on this issue, and this is one that's really key for your congressional delegation and the work that you're doing, as we discover more information, and this is critical, we still believe that federal law should respect the process that's been set up in the state for the appropriation, distribution, and decision related to the use of these monies that come in. As you can well imagine, we have occasional to-dos with the executive branch over these issues.
And this is Kurt Schaefer. Was that a response to my education question?
That is a partial response to your education question.
Okay, and the reason I raise that, in some of the preliminary language that I saw at least last week, there was actually sub-pots of money within education that were called, for example, the primary and secondary education modernization and improvement portion, and there was a similar analogous pot of money for higher ed. So it seemed to be that there would be some restrictions to limit those to capital improvements, and I'm wondering if that's what we're still seeing.
This is Molly Ramsdell from NCSL. While I'm not NCSL's education person, I was able to find that at least in the Senate proposal, there is $16 billion to repair, renovate, and construct public schools in ways, and then there's energy efficiency requirements that come with those funds, that are tied to those funds. And there's an additional $3.5 billion to improve higher education facilities. On the House side, there are some funds as it relates to impact aid construction and credit enhancement for charter school facilities, but I wasn't able to identify quickly any large pots of money as similar to that in the Senate for the school construction, renovation, and repair. But we could have we could look into that further and have our education person get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
And Senator, also on the tax side, both the House and the Senate bills have got provisions for the use of private activity bonds or tax-exempt bonds or tax credit bonds for a variety of construction efforts. I think we have got one more response for you here.
This is Molly Ramsdell from NCSL. We were able to find the provisions in the House bill. They do provide $14 billion for repair and modernization of K through 12. So again, just a little shy of the Senate's $12 billion, and they have $6 billion for higher education repair and modernization.
Great. Can I ask one more follow-up question? Do we know the formula of how this is going to be given out to states? Is it going to be a big-picture distribution, or will it be by subtopics such as education, roads and bridges, and things like that? Do we have an idea of that?
For the education funds in particular?
Well, that in particular, but everything across the board, are these single pots where everything is lumped together for all the subjects and then distributed to the states?
The funds will be distributed through a number of mechanisms, being existing programs. For example, you know, the education funds would go through the Title I formula, and the highway funds will be the safety loop formula.
Okay.
And there's, you know, all the different formulas. So it's not a simple answer.
Okay. But I think that answers my question, though. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question, sort of a follow-up. This is Eric Schmidt. So just to have a better understanding in the macro of how these decisions are going to be made, there seem to be subcategories of funding. And then who is making the decision as to who receives? Because I know there are school districts making applications. There's money set aside for that is what it sounds like, but there are specific districts making applications for renovations or improvements. Who's making those decisions? Because are those applications going to the Fed? Is that a state decision? Is the governor? I mean, we talked about this a little bit, but could you fill us in on what you know right now? It's kind of a broad question, but it's important.
This is Molly Renzo. I can only speak to the transportation And in most cases, it's got to be on, you know, the state plan, and there's some requirements related to it as well. Michael, did you have any? Or Tamara's going to add. Hold on.
With regards to some of the energy programs in the bill in the House, there are a few competitive grant programs. There's also some that pots of money that are designated for particular types of institutions or research and development as well within energy. The SRF money for the state revolving funds is going to go through EPA using the normal distribution process for both the drinking water and clean water SRF. So that would, and then those programs would require that projects that are ready to go be part of those their state plans and their needs survey. So it's going to, again, depend on which small piece you're talking about.
This is Molly from NCSL again. As we mentioned before, how it was going, the money was going to be distributed according to existing formulas. I think the thing to remember there is that there's a process for each of these formulas where decisions are made that exist now for how these funds are spent. And for the most part, you know, whoever it is in your state who makes those decisions now will most likely continue to make those decisions regarding the new funding. There are a few exceptions, though, and, you know, for example, we talked a little bit about, you know, the stabilization fund, the second part of that money, which the governor has full authority over.
And that's what changes.
Correct.
Yeah, I think, Senator, just a little more information, and that is, as this legislation has evolved, I mean, we and also the governor's office have approached, folks who do highways and bridges, mass transit, clean water and drinking water facilities. So I think as part of your activity, it's probably advisable that you check with your state agencies to see what projects they've identified, because that has certainly been used in the calculations that are found in each of these bills in terms of how much money actually could be applied to projects that, as Molly said, are either ready to go or shovel ready, whatever terminology you might be using.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions right now. You guys are going to hang on the line. I'm under your understanding in case there's other questions. Is that correct?
Sure.
Okay, great. All right, we're going to go ahead and move on. Like to call Paul Wilson from the Office of Governor Jay Nixon. Paul, you have some comments, and then we'll open it up to questions from the senators.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, my name is Paul Wilson. I'm the Governor's Senior Counsel for Budget and Finance. We appreciate the opportunity to appear before the committee. Obviously, much of what we were prepared to discuss, you've gotten a briefing on already. I'd like to highlight just a couple of items that were presented to you on this phone call, and also to point out a couple of things that were said last night when the governor introduced his budget for FY 2010. The first is that there is no money coming through this stimulus bill that the governor is counting on in order to bring the fiscal 2009 budget in balance, to get us through June 30 of 2009. Without spending money that we don't have. As you know, the fiscal 2009 budget purported to spend far more money than we will actually have to spend. The governor is implementing a series of expense reductions to make sure that what we do spend does not exceed what we will have to spend in terms of tax revenues, and he is not counting on any of the money that was just described to you in order to do that. That's the first piece, and an important piece. There are many states around the country that are counting on these funds in order to bring their current fiscal years into balance. The state of Missouri does not have to do that, and we are not going to do that. Second is the what was described to you is a large number of different streams of funding, and each of them, as was mentioned, will be running, for the most part, will be running through existing culverts, if you will, going from a small trickle sometimes to a flood, but nevertheless, they're going to run these programs through existing formulas, through existing programs, and that's going to require a high level of cooperation between the executive branch and the legislative branch to coordinate the use of those funds. Those programs are the same programs that you see in the budget that was presented to you last night, that you've seen in prior budgets, that you'll see in future budgets. When he's talking about Title I funding, or IDEA funding, that's funding is already in the state's budget. We already anticipate normal federal funding in those areas. It's distributed by appropriation. It's distributed to the local school districts under existing formulas. So there isn't anything new about the process. What's new is the size of that money. So we will be working with the legislative branch, both in the current fiscal year, if any one of these individual separate streams of money begins to flow in fiscal 09 and in fiscal 10, to make sure that these separately identified programs of money can be moved as quickly as possible, that we can access the most funds available for these individual programs. A large list of them was run down for you in your hearing. I won't repeat it for you, but it is a little bit mind-boggling. The bills are 600 or 700 pages each, as they described to you. There's now two competing versions, one in the House, one in the Senate. The number of separate programs being funded is more than 50 in one. It's almost 50 in the other. This is an enormous undertaking. The numbers that they're throwing out, $800-900 billion. It's worth pausing to note that this is not recreational. The Congress of the United States is not used to writing bills for funding anything that much, that fast, with this little process, to put it through the House in a matter of weeks, to put it through the Senate and the House before the middle of February, which may be March, we don't know. The reason they're doing that is because the national and international economies are really right now standing on the edge of a razor. And left and right and center have all agreed, at least in Washington, that extraordinary action is necessary right now to keep this economy from going from recession into something worse. So that decision is not yours. That decision is being made in Congress as to whether a large amount of funding right now through existing programs can make a difference in the international and national economies. What will be your decision is how you use those separate little streams of money when they come to the state, and the extent to which we access those, and the extent to which we can make the very best use of those, not just in their targeted areas, not just in building K-12 schools or building highways or maintaining bridges, but also using those as the means to jumpstart the economy, because that's what underneath everything else is what's going on here. There isn't a national emergency that we spend another $100 billion on weatherization. There's a national emergency that Congress is going to pump money into this economy, and one of the ways they're going to do it is with weatherization funds. That's a program that's found its way into each bill in one fashion or another, and I think, at least in part, because it allows ordinary federal spending for low-income heating assistance to go farther if we can get into some of these low-income homes and make a real difference in their weatherization, so that next year and 5 years from now, Senator, and 10 years from now, the same old level of LIHEAP money will go farther because the homes will hold the heat in better. But it's also the kind of program that you can put people to work right now doing. It's the kind of program where if you have a large influx of cash that you can actually move out the door, not just for low-income housing, but for state and local buildings to make sure that they're just as energy efficient as they can be, so that you get a short-term economic benefit because you're putting people to work. You're putting not just the folks who do that work, but the folks who make the products that are being put into place. But you get the long-term benefit because you actually come out of it with a more energy-efficient government building, a more energy-efficient local government building, or a more energy-efficient low-income housing project. That's an example of how it seems to me that this legislature is going to have to address itself to the opportunity to make sure that we get both the short-term economic bump that we need to get the economy up off its knees here, but the long-term benefit from it in the areas, the program areas that they're trying to fund. Now, I want to underscore that all of what I just talked about and more than 90% of everything that the folks from NCSL talked about are these separate funding streams for construction, for infrastructure, for broadband, for weatherization, all of those things. That's the economic stimulus portion of this trillion-dollar bill that you've heard about. There is also a portion that's titled in both the House version and the Senate version, State Budget Stabilization Funds. And that's the money. It's less than 10% in both bills. It's smaller in one than in another. That is intended for states to access to prevent downsizing in essential government services during this period where the economy is underperforming, to allow the states to continue to provide essential services while the economy is recovering, so that as it recovers, you replace those stimulus funds, Senator, with general revenue. If the stimulus works, the stimulus that's going all around us, the $1 trillion that's being spent by Congress, works, then we'll replace the $800 million that the governor had proposed in the 2010 budget, which is Missouri's a conservative estimate of Missouri's share of this one small part for budget stabilization. We'll be replacing that with general revenue. If that doesn't work, the state will have a lot more serious problems than replacing that $800 million, because we will still have the same 7.5%, 8.5% unemployment that we're staring in the face now. That means that we're still going to have the million people in the state on food stamps that we have now. So the replacing that $800 million, less than 10% of the overall general revenue pile, is, while important, that will be a natural result of getting the economy up off of its knees. And if that doesn't happen, it will be a much less serious problem than the problem we're going to have, because we'll have a state that is going into its second and third and fourth year of a serious recession, if not worse. So that's the idea behind the stimulus bill in Washington. That's the opportunity that these funds are giving to you and to the state of Missouri and to the governor, as he proposed in his budget last night. We have an estimate of these state budget stabilization funds, which, as I said, is one portion, less than 10% of the overall pie, that we have a conservative estimate of Missouri's share of that we have put in at 809.2, which we derived using a Medicaid enhanced match rate, which, as they described, is the mechanism that Congress is looking at for moving these funds to the states. And we derive that number using an enhancement that is now less than either the Senate or the House version. When we say it's a conservative estimate, that's what we mean, that right now what is in the House is higher than the number we used. Right now what's coming out of the Senate looks to be higher, if not much higher. There are also other types of funds that have been looked at in one house or the other. that could fall under this category of budget stabilization. That's not what we've estimated. That's not what's included in this budget. What's included in this budget is the same mechanical device that was used in 2003, 2004 to move almost a couple hundred million bucks into Missouri, and that's an increase in the federal match rate. So when that's how we arrived at that number. That's what that number is being provided for by Congress. We're using it as they intend. The maintenance of effort that would be required for Missouri is not a problem. Currently, our MAF percentage is the lowest allowed by federal law, so there's no question that we would be lowering that in the interim, or will have lowered it in the last 12 months, which would have disqualified us for these funds. So we're qualified for the funds. We know they're going to come. We know they're going to come in at or above the level that we're estimating. And when they come, as was the case in 2003-2004, they are by definition general revenue.
Great. Thank you, Paul. Any questions or comments from the senators? Senator Crowell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your briefing, and I apologize for missing a part of that. I had to step out. But I think I got the gist of where you're going, and I was here. I do remember that. We ended up still issuing $365 million in bonds to make up a $89 million shortfall that we just couldn't bear to be able to deal with, even though we did get those federal funds that went through. And I do see Linda there, and I know she was part of the lump sum budget through then the Senate's, then the special sessions and everything else. And it's my hope, my sincere hope, that as we go through this and get a better understanding of where these federal funds are, that we can communicate without gag orders, we can communicate honestly and openly as we are doing now, and applaud you for doing so, so that we can really understand what we're getting into. And I appreciate your willingness to be here and doing that as we look at that. My first question would be, what is the enhanced match rate that you did plug into your budget? What exactly was that number?
The briefing that we gave to the Senate Appropriations Committee this morning and to staff last night had a worksheet that shows it was 4.8% as the base adjustment and an additional adjustment of 2%.
Upward or downward?
An additional upward adjustment of 2%, which would be, it's what the House calls the House in Washington, the House version of the bill calls the unemployment adjustment. We would be a Tier 1 state. We had a jump in unemployment during the fourth quarter of 2008 of 1.9 points. That put us in the Tier 1 of states who had a disproportionately high increase during that quarter, which would then qualify us under their rubric in the House version for an additional adjustment. The adjustment we counted on there was 2. It may be higher. It may be higher in the Senate if they're experimenting with either an adjustment that is a base that is higher or an adjustment that's in addition to unemployment takes into account other factors.
Okay.
So you would get additional adjustments for each of unemployment or food stamps or several other criteria.
Correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe I'm not just understanding this, but the NCSL people told us that the House version, they didn't understand the Senate version, but the House version had a 4.9% increase.
And they had not gotten to the discussion of the she mentioned the increases for unemployment. She didn't talk about
it. So that would be in addition to the Medicaid, and it all goes into your Medicaid.
No. There is a base adjustment to the FMAP of 4.8%.
In your assumption.
I'm going on an earlier draft of the same legislation, and this current draft has the same thing, except it's higher. It's 4.9.
4.9.
And an FMAP adjustment over and above that depending on whether or not your state suffered a disproportionately high level of unemployment in the fourth quarter of 2008. That level was 2% prior draft. It's 2% or higher now, as I understand the current draft.
In the House version or the Senate version?
House version. And the Senate version was toying around with either a higher adjustment or a series of adjustments that would take the number much higher than 6.8 or 6.9 or even higher than that.
Okay. And with that being the case on where your assumptions are, it is also my understanding that the current budget has proposals in it to increase our eligibility for Medicaid with these funds. Is that correct?
It has a proposal to increase eligibility for Medicaid. That's not contingent on receiving these funds, and the price calculated for that was not calculated using this new enhanced match. It was calculated using the same standard match rate that we apply to all of our Medicaid forecasts if and when that happens. These adjustments are applied, you would earn this extra money on those expenditures as well.
Okay.
But that's not built into the cost of that program.
Okay. I'm not a budget guy. You're speaking way over me. So from what I understand with that is you're saying the budget you proposed is balanced without the federal enhanced dollars?
No, what I said was that the price tag for the enhancement in Medicaid that we're proposing was calculated using the same base rate, the same FMAP rate that we count on month in and month out, without regard for the stimulus bill. If these adjustments are made, you will earn this additional 6.8 points or 6.9 points under the current draft or higher on those expenditures as well.
And you're wanting to use that money to do the eligibility increases within Medicaid?
The eligibility increases are being paid for out of the same general revenue pot that's paying for everything else.
So I understand it then. You're not relying on the federal funds to do your eligibility increases. Under your budget, it's balanced with the increases in eligibility regardless of the amount of federal funds that comes in.
Under the budget the governor proposed last night, there is no more reliance on the increase in Medicaid eligibility on the federal stimulus money than there is on the federal stimulus money for your salary or mine.
I don't understand that at all. You budgeted $800 million, but you're saying you're not relying on it?
The $809 million will become general revenue, just as it did in 03 and 04.
Okay.
And it's being spent, among other things, on your salary and mine and the Medicaid program and, under the budget he proposed last night, an increase in the Medicaid program by raising the eligibility from the federal minimum up to 50% of poverty.
Okay. Understood. Then that's where that is. What happens, hypothetically speaking, when we don't get any more federal bailout money and we have increased our eligibility rates? And as I said previously to NCSL, and correct me if I'm wrong in your calculations, we, as I understand it, would need 7.4% growth in the state of Missouri's GR funds for fiscal year 2011, whenever the federal money goes away, to basically make up that federal funds. Do you agree with that assumption or disagree?
I don't know where the 7.4% comes from. If that's the... if that is the increase that $809 million represents to the overall general revenue budget, then I would tell you that that's not only very doable, it's practically essential to get the state back in working order again. If you take – you can't look at it as the single bridge between 2010 and 2011. If you look at where we were in 2008 – if we had normal economic growth, just normal economic growth, for 09 and 10 and into 11, we would be far above what it would need to fund this budget and the 2011.
What are you defining as normal growth?
It is typically 4% or slightly higher than that. That's the year-over-year typical normal growth increase. Last year for 2009, it was budgeted or forecast at slightly less than that, at 3.4%. It turned out to be disastrously upside down. We're backing up 4% from 2008. If we can turn that around, and if you look at the general revenue that occurred after we turned around the 2002 and 2003 recession, which was a much milder recession, there was a substantial bounce in the recovery, and I think that we can count on that, and I think we can count on the sustained effect that you would get by 70, 80, or 1,000 or more jobs that would be created if we were not looking at historically high unemployment rates.
What happens if that doesn't happen? I'll tell you, that is the attitude that this General Assembly had. And by the way, you're welcome that we didn't spend all of the money, and you had a great fund balance to deal with where you went forward, where you are now in crafting this budget. What happens if it doesn't happen? We have had a philosophy here that we don't spend every dollar that comes in. And making sure. I mean, I don't know. You've been around in here. I don't think Governor Carnahan left Governor Holden the amount of money that Governor Blunt left Governor Nixon. Correct me if I'm wrong. But we've had that philosophy. What happens if all of your assumptions don't work out?
Senator, I can state what I said before, which is that if the state cannot recover this economy over the next 18 months to 24 months, yes, that will be a problem, replacing this general revenue. But it will be a small problem compared to the other problems the state is going to face if we're going to still be carrying 7.5%, 8%, or 8.5% unemployment at that time. There's a reason Congress is making a trillion-dollar throwdown here. That's not something that they would ordinarily ever have done. It's something that they've made the decision on the left and the right to do because it's a very serious problem that they're facing. It's up to the states to take that money and make it work. It's up to the states to turn the economy around using the money they're going to provide. Whether they send it directly to a local school district or send it to the General Assembly, either way, Washington isn't going to spend that money. They're not going to turn the economy around. They're going to send cash and hope that the state of Missouri can turn it around using that cash to fund these various programs. Again, one small part of which we're now discussing with respect to this $800 million in 2010. The rest of it, and the much larger portion of it, is what was discussed earlier on the phone call. That's the construction money, the infrastructure money, broadband for rural areas, safe water, safe drinking water. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And those are the areas which have to be maximized. Coordination has to be had at a high level between the state government and local governments, between the branches of state government, and between state government and the federal government.
And I appreciate that. I believe my only concern and what I want to make sure we all have an open and honest discussion on is how we use one-time funds for ongoing expenses within this General Assembly and the obligations that are there. I could not concur with you more that we need to be in a position and appreciate your aggressive work in using the broadband, the highway construction, the one-time funds that then don't have ongoing operating. It's my concern and my focus that I want to make sure we don't take the juice from the federal government and have to go through a hard withdrawal. I did not enjoy in any way, shape, or form having to vote for 539, but something had to be done. And I want to make sure that the individual that holds this seat after I'm done finds Missouri in a better position. You know, I often joke that I felt like when I got elected after the Carnahan administration that I had to clean up after the kegger. It was not fun to be around here. I know Governor Holden didn't like it. No one else liked it. And I want to make sure that we don't take this federal stimulus dollars and party with it and leave the state of Missouri a little bit worse and force other legislatures to fix those problems. So that's my concerns, and thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you, Senator Ferguson.
Do you have some of the numbers that you're getting from how many jobs will be created off this? Because the Congressional Budget Office couldn't figure out where any jobs would be created. The same thing was instituted in Japan for 10 years with 8 stimulus packages, and the economy increased 0.06% in, was it 12 years? I think it was 12 years. The Congressional Budget Office and then the House Tax Committee staff can't estimate even one job will be created. And then if you do create the jobs at 4 million jobs, the amount of job created was $217,000 per job created. I'm just trying to run those numbers of when you spend that money, much money to create one job, I'm trying to figure out if there might be other ways that we could go to creating jobs other than government funding.
I hear your arguments. I hear them on C-SPAN when I watch Congress where that debate's being held. What we're doing here is spending the money that they're going to send. Now, that debate
your answer is that your statistics show that we're going to have so much growth that in 2 years we're not going to need this money and we're going to be right back on track. So you're using – I'm just trying to figure out the argument that you're using. I'm from Missouri. You're going to have to show me when you say that many jobs are going to be created and the very people that are writing the bill have no idea if it'll create any jobs. I don't know where you're getting that this will be such a big job creation bill that we'll have – 80,000 jobs created when, by their estimates, they don't know if it'll create any jobs.
What I'm saying is if you can't create those jobs, then you can't get the economy back. And, yes, you will have to replace the stimulus money with something, but you will also have a series of other and much more serious problems. So the governor spoke at length last night about job creation as the top priority. The leadership in both houses has committed to that as a top priority. That's not dependent on what Congress is doing or not doing. That needs to happen and is going to happen. I'm not sure that concern is. While relevant to the debate that's ongoing in Congress, if Congress ultimately votes out one or the other of these bills, which every indication is they will do and do quickly, then the job for Missouri, for the General Assembly, the governor, and everyone else, is going to be to use it to the very best advantage. And if we can't create the one job you're talking about, then we will have failed miserably with that opportunity. So...
that's okay. We can debate this all day long, but just for clarification, these 80,000 jobs that are going to be created, they're private sector jobs? Because it makes me wonder when you grow the there's two ways of growing the economy. You can grow it through government, the growth of government, or you can grow it through the private sector. And it just seems to me like we're growing government jobs rather than private sector jobs. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This morning when I brought up the 04 federal money that was received, part of it was to acknowledge that there was a time in recent memory when the state used federal money to balance the budget. My intent was to further add that the circumstances that we have here today are very different than they were at that time. I'm not an economist, but I do believe that the downturn was partially brought on by an extraordinary event being September the 11th, the shaking of the financial markets, of course, the decimation of the airline industry, and other very negative factors. In addition to that, it came shortly after the whole, Y2K, where I believe there was a bunch of spending to update technology. And And then furthermore, as we got out of September the 11th, one of the industries that was leading us out was the housing industry. And I would submit that it was part of the problems that we're dealing with today, and poor lending practices led to some of that growth that we experienced during the time in between that downturn and what we're experiencing today. So to have federal assistance that is three times the level that we received in 2004, and then with an expectation of growth that will match what we did prior to this downturn, I think is a miscalculation. And especially when we're looking at expansion of programs, I think we need to tread very lightly and not obligate this state for money that's likely to not be there just over 2 years from now.
Any further questions for Mr. Paul Wilson?
I've got one quick one.
All right, Mr.
Chairman. Paul, so do I understand correctly that the governor's using $809 million of the federal money to balance the budget out for fiscal year 2010, correct?
The included in the general revenue estimate for the budget he presented last night is $802 million.
Okay,
and the budget stabilization portion of the
federal. That's right, and that's my question. That $809 million, that comes from the economic stabilization portion, which is separate from capital improvement for all the other things like that.
Yeah, they call it the state budget, the state fiscal stabilization fund.
Okay, and then am I to understand correctly that that money is pretty much just fully discretionary for the governor?
That money is general revenue. It's fully discretionary.
I mean, as it comes from the federal government to the state. In other words, we're going to have these potential other pots of money that are for road improvement, bridge improvement, but this chunk of money, at least $109 million that you're counting on to balance the budget, is discretionary for the governor to spend as general revenue. Correct?
Well, I'm not sure that the discretionary for the governor to spend. The governor spends money with an appropriation. So
I understand that.
But, yes, the strings on it, if that's the question, is they are minimal. In other words, you cannot roll back your eligibility. You have to have a program that's at least as favorable from the enrollee's perspective,
right,
as you had in 2008.
Right. And so with everything we've just been talking about, the incentive would be to use that $108 million to create as many jobs as possible, correct?
The
$109
million? The
$809 million, excuse me, to create as many jobs as possible, correct?
If that were the only money in the entire federal stimulus bill, we could have a discussion about that. Because that's the money that's intended for states to stabilize their budget and to prevent cuts in essential services, while the rest of the other 90-plus percent of the federal stimulus bill is at work, then no, I don't think your statement's correct. I think that the rest of that money that's going to come through this legislature and out into the community and around this legislature into local governments or school districts or however it flows will be creating jobs and generating economic growth. And so in the meantime, what Congress has designated this money for is to stabilize governmental budgets so that essential services don't need to be cut down to the bone until the economy recovers.
Senator Ridgway.
Thank you. Just a couple of things. I'm sort of hearing people talking at each other here, and I just want to ask a couple of questions here to see if we can get down to some fundamental agreement. Maybe that agreement was expressed before. Unfortunately, I was in the jobs, or fortunately, I was in the Jobs and Economic Development Committee meeting, so I was a little bit late to this one. Do we have a fundamental agreement here that any money that we might choose to take from the federal government should be used only for non-recurring one-time expenses?
The governor proposed his budget last night. You can characterize any of the expenses in there any way you want. It includes $809.2 million as part of that stream of funding that was described by NCSL at the beginning, that runs for out past just 2010.
Let me stop you there. Let me ask the question another way. Do you believe that it is the governor's philosophy that we should only use this money for one-time expenditures and not in any way lock us into recurring expenditures?
The governor's philosophy is that which is set out in his speech last night and in the budget that was released this morning. All of the expenditures in there are one-time in the sense that it's a single-year operating budget.
Hey, but we can say that we're spinning our wheels here. I think what you're telling me is the governor is willing to lock us in to ongoing expenditures using federal bailout money that is going to obligate this state way down the road for ongoing growth and Medicaid and things like that. And I don't think I'm hearing anything from you to the contrary, that we've got to really be careful. If we as a legislature, if our philosophy is one time only, I don't think the governor's in agreement with that based on what you're telling me.
What I've told you is, I'd be happy to repeat it, the Medicaid expansion that we're talking about has mm-hmm. $37 million worth of general revenue in it. That doesn't depend upon the $809 million that we're talking about. It doesn't not depend upon it. It is a general revenue expenditure just like everything else. It covers up to 62,000 Missourians who need help now, and it does it at a cost that is on a per-person basis very advantageous and yet doesn't even take into account the 6 or 7% additional earnings that we would have on that money with this FMAPing.
Can we at least agree that any time we expand Medicaid, that we are expanding an entitlement program that has annual, recurring, ongoing expenses that are required to grow?
The eligibility standards for Medicaid are set year by year in the appropriations bill. They've gone backwards and they've gone forwards. So, no, I would not agree to that.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. The folks in my district probably pay more federal taxes than they do state taxes. They're infuriated by this entire bailout. I'm half inclined as a legislature to tell the federal government, take their stimulus and shove it. But that's probably not likely to happen because everybody seems to be at the trough for our federal dollars. So they've paid the federal dollars. Then they get the whole bunch of money taken off the top at the federal level. Then it comes back to the state. They get a whole bunch more money they're taken off the top. And we're supposed to be grateful because we get pennies on the dollar for the federal taxes they've already paid. Federal government wants to do us a favor, lower the dang taxes so that we get 100% of it. So I've said my speech for the day, but this entire process is very frustrating because I don't think I can get anybody to straight talk here that we can't spend anything that we take on an ongoing expenditure. It would be wildly fiscally irresponsible to do so. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very briefly, and I just wanted, this is more of a point of clarification. So your understanding, and this was kind of a follow-up on the question I asked the folks on the phone, the $800 million that we're getting or we're counting on in the governor's proposal last night is GR. That's GR money. That's the stabilization money that you referenced, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And then using the same example that I used on the phone, if a school district is making an application for greater energy efficiency or winterization for their schools or improvements, that's different money, correct?
As I understand it, that is right. That's the money that we're going to need the highest degree of cooperation and the most communication with the congressional delegation in Washington to maximize and access. I mean, that's the money that comes in much, much higher amounts, frankly, than we're talking about with this line.
Great. Thank you, Paul. We really appreciate your testimony and your time. Do have a few other people that did come to address the committee. I got Rich Aubuchon from Lieutenant Governor's Office. I don't think you were planning on saying anything or
make myself available for the committee.
You are a great American. Okay, Gary Marble on behalf of the newest Congressman, Blaine Lueckdemeyer.
I'll be very brief, Mr. Chairman. I did have one comment I wanted to make, and most everything else has been covered. I'm Gary Marble, District Director and Deputy Chief of Staff for Congressman Lichtenmeyer. We do have a concern as we visited with the city managers and commissioners throughout the 9th Congressional, and that is concerning the permitting process that will be inevitable, in particularly with capital-type projects that you're talking about funding. My experience has been that it can take 3-6 months to get permits from the Department of Natural Resources, the other type of permitting that is necessary to begin a construction process. And I've asked the EPA and DC. We've not gotten a response from them. We've ran the traps, and apparently no one's really looking at this. So I would encourage this committee to at least investigate some sort of a streamlined permitting process that would allow the money that is received by the state, once it hits the ground, that those construction projects can begin fairly rapidly, and you don't have to go through a lengthy period of waiting on permitting in order to begin. And actually, the word we got back was that, in fact, I believe in Mr. Wilson's testimony, he said, we will use the existing programs, existing culverts, we'll just have more money. The big difference is what we do not have is time. You're going to have 180 days to spend half your money, and the way things go currently, most of that 180 days will be spent waiting on a permit to be approved. So I would encourage you to at least investigate that and see if there's something that could potentially be done. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Gary. Appreciate it. Any questions for Mr. Marble? Seeing none, thank you for your time and your patience, sir. We got Danny Roeder from Congressman Cleaver's office. Thank you, Danny, for traveling to meet with us.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure to do so. I'll be available afterwards if anyone has any questions. I didn't want to hold you up too much longer, except to say a couple caveats on some of the things that have been said earlier today. STEMIA's package, as it's designed, if it does not hit the street in a quick manner and with some force, i.e. a lot of money, which is the way that Congress has devised it, it may not work, and the problem that we're talking about 2 years down the road of running into the state budget of a lapsing state budget year after year after year may in fact be where we're at. So the Congress has designed this plan, and in part has designed this plan with crossed fingers, that in fact it will be sent out to the states, and the states will spend that money quickly, get it into the pockets of Missourians, and be able to claim in a couple of years that we are starting to see a recovery out of the economic times that we're in. I have some specific numbers that if anyone's interested as far as what the Missouri allocations, at least by formula, we can project. I also have some specific numbers on the school districts, which I think maybe some of you might be interested in, your specific school districts that you represent as far as their allocations might be. For instance, the Kansas City School District is looking at an allocation of $48 million additional dollars, and the independent school district of Senator Callahan is looking at about a $6 million increase. So I have those across the state if anybody's interested in those, and I'm glad to answer any questions.
Oscar, thank you for making yourself available after the meeting so those people can get that information from you. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. And then our last and final person that I know of is Gary Olmsted on behalf of St. Charles County Executive Steve Ellman, former Senator Steve Ellman. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I just wanted to mention, particularly on transportation, that this is a great opportunity to build a lot of infrastructure that's in the program presently all over the state of Missouri and in the urbanized areas. These are our dollars that we've sent to Washington. We're recovering them back. The 100% reimbursement that comes back here on the infrastructure, I think we should be getting ready to accept those dollars and to streamline the process so that those dollars can go into those projects that are already on the program. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Mr. Olmsted? Thank you. Make sure you fill out a witness form, all those that did that did speak. In the interest of first off, is there anyone else that has traveled on behalf of a congressman or a local elected authority? Okay, seeing none, if there's no other questions from the committee, we're going to go ahead and adjourn. I want to thank everybody's time. Thank the governor's office, lieutenant governor's office, the congressman's office, and NCSL for the great information. Check out NCSL's website. I think there's a good resource there.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks, guys.